Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
It's almost 52 years so far, the world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer species on the planet than the year before that. We're driving 200 species a day to extinction. We're about to see that turn around. The loving planet is about to make a comeback, and that's really, really good news.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. This is Nature Bats Last. It's NBL on PRN.FM. We're broadcasting tonight from the campus of California State University in beautiful Chico, California. I'm Guy McPherson. I'm going solo tonight. I look forward to the return of my friend and co-host, Mike Sliva. Mike's clearly the brains behind this operation. I'm just filling in for a few weeks while he's elsewhere. Our theme song is provided as a gift, with our thanks, by Afrazen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud. Tonight's first segment highlights news beyond the echo chamber of the mainstream. First up, from an article hosted September 26th at FireDogLake.com, comes this headline: Secret Goldman Sachs tapes reveal culture of corruption at Federal Reserve. The article includes the following lines, quote, "An examiner of Goldman Sachs made 46 hours of secret recordings of the Fed and Goldman interacting. The interactions often involved the Fed helping Goldman evade regulations and cover up misdeeds. The tapes provide overwhelming evidence, if any more evidence was needed, that the Federal Reserve is a completely and hopelessly captured regulator and that it is subservient to the people and organizations it is supposed to be overseeing." End quote. The entire system is irredeemably, fundamentally corrupt. There is no hope for reforming it. The only relevant goal is to terminate it. From realpolitics.com the same day, that's from realclearpolitics.com the same day, comes a story pointing out the complete lack of transparency coming from the Obama administration. Delaware Congressional Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton lectured her colleagues in the House Oversight Committee with this doozy of a line, which has now been made widely available on YouTube. Quote, "You don't have a right to know everything in a separation of powers government, my friend. That is the difference between a parliamentary government and a separation of powers government," end quote. There you have it. If you still have faith in this government, if you're still trying to reform that which cannot be reformed, if you're still using political tools in an attempt to transform the corrupt political process, then I must wonder why people call you sane and me insane. A line from Krishnamurti comes immediately to mind. "It is no measure of health to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society." This society is profoundly sick. We cling to our luxuries as if they are entitlements. We refuse to take responsibility for the most fundamental of necessities, including securing clean water and healthy food. And we suffer the consequences by regularly ingesting poison disguised as water and food. We don't take responsibility for ourselves. We capitulate to the nanny step at every turn. Repeat after me, fellow Americans. We're number one. As regular listeners know by now, we offer brief opinion pieces each week. In this segment, we hear from radical perspectives, that cut to the root of an issue and expose some truth that has been widely hidden, ignored, or filed under oblivious for the general populace. We call this segment Breaking Opium. This week's contribution comes from a regular voice on this show. My colleague Forrest Palmer talks about the climate march in New York City 10 days ago. Its portrayal in the media by the self-proclaimed liberal / left is reminiscent of the march on Washington in 1963. Take it away, Forrest.
On September 21st, 2014, the biggest climate march in history happened in New York City. Anywhere from 300,000 to 400,000 people walked a state-mandated route through the streets to shine a light on climate change, which is slowly being accepted as the bellwether event to end Western civilization and maybe our existence on Earth. As this was a mass gathering of people for a righteous cause, the narrative portrayed in the media on the liberal left is that this is reminiscent of the hallowed March on Washington back on August 28, 1963, the apex of black and liberal white solidarity that has been viewed as the point where this country starts to turn the tide and bring a non-white supremacist state. Although all evidence points to the contrary, this is still the belief amongst the masses. But what I would tell anyone is that what you saw on Sunday wasn't the second coming of the March on Washington, since even that show of power in numbers led to an ultimately minuscule change in black circumstances with the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act that were passed shortly thereafter. I would suggest instead that people look at Sunday as another meeting in Washington that happened 30 years later, the Million Man March. On October 16, 1995, 1 million or so black people, almost exclusively men, as it was an exercise in patriarchy and misogyny, went to Washington for a nebulous day of atonement. Atone for what? I still have no proof to this day, since asking black people to inexplicably atone is like asking a rape victim to apologize for being raped. That being said, this meeting was put together by the demagogue Louis Farrakhan, who led these people to the city as a sign of black people apologizing in general and then leaving there to go back to their neighborhoods to put everything straight in the black community. And what was the end result other than a feel-good moment? Nothing. In every measurable way, things have become significantly worse for black men in this country, from incarceration levels, unemployment, mortality rates, and poverty. The reason is that other than this one day of solidarity, there was no agreed-upon plan in place by the people that ran the Million Man March or the people themselves to rectify any of the problems which made them congregate there in the first place. There was nothing, and the end result was exactly the same. So in that vein, this climate march will be as unimportant regarding combating climate change as the Million Man March was in solving any of the problems plaguing black people today. Unless I'm crazy, I don't believe that one step was taken the day after from a societal level to deal with any of the issues expressed by the multitude of so-called leaders at the climate march or the people who follow them. Personally, I woke up the next morning after the climate march, and my life was exactly the same as it was the day before, reminiscent of the Million Man March. Sadly, the only thing now for me to do is watch it play itself out again along the climate narrative as it did concerning the black narrative the past 20 years, but with much higher stakes. As humanity has rarely learned anything after all these thousands of years, I have no doubt that history will most definitely repeat itself.
You're listening to Nature Bats Laugh on the Progressive Radio Network. Thanks very much, Forrest. You can catch me every Tuesday at this time, usually with my sidekick, Mike Sleva. My guest tonight is Corey Morningstar. Morningstar is an independent investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist. She focuses her efforts on global ecological collapse and political analysis of the nonprofit industrial complex. She resides in Canada. Her recent writings can be found on Wrong Kind of Green, The Art of Annihilation, Political Context, Counterpunch, Canadians for Action on Climate Change, and Countercurrents. Her writing also has been published by Bolivia Rising and Cambio, the official newspaper of the plurinational state of Bolivia. Corey, thanks for joining Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, Guy. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I very much appreciate you taking the time to be with us tonight.
So Obama is not going to save us.
some of us have known that for quite a while.
Halloween again.
Yes. So tell us a little about yourself. Why do you do what you do?
I mean, there's not that much to tell. I'm a mom. I'm a, you know, a daughter. I'm a sister. I care about my Mother Earth. You know, people less fortunate, people exploited, so we can, you know, pretend we're very, very, very happy in this messed up system. I do my work because years ago I figured out that no one wanted to tell the truth and talk about reality, and so I felt, I don't know, I guess it sort of fell upon my shoulders because I don't really care if people like me. I'm more interested in getting the truth out there, and that's, you know, a sufficient reward for me. So, yeah, I just started writing. I don't really write to please people. I write just to get the truth out. And I think there's a big difference in that. And, yeah, I'm just trying to, you know, live day to day and be the best I can be and make sense of insanity.
Well, you're absolutely right. You aren't writing to please people. That's pretty clear because you write from a very radical perspective. I rarely read one of your essays without learning at least one new significant thing. And frequently I learn many new significant things. Now, your writing is not exactly well-suited to the American audience and probably not to the Canadian audience because you do two things that I think really reduce your readership. First of all, you write from a really radical perspective. You get to the root. You don't sugarcoat anything. Secondly, you write long essays. We're Twitter Nation. I don't know about Canada, but I suspect it's much the same. Anything longer than a soundbite is pretty tough for Americans to deal with. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Because I know that what I do is not going to stop what's happening. You know, we basically let a monster out of the cage and we're not going to get it back in. We have no leaders. Those quote-unquote leaders are never, ever going to quote-unquote save us. You know, people are enamored by this system that, you know, exploits others so we can have consumer junk and debt and a lot of unhappiness and sickness that goes hand in hand with all of that. And so basically my work serves, I guess, as a record of what's happened, you know, and how it's gotten this way and why with all these, you know, quote-unquote movements, we've failed miserably, why we continue to fail. People who are interested will read it, and people, you know, and obviously that takes work and discipline, and people will read it who really do want to understand and further their knowledge. And, yeah, the majority of people, you know, won't, but that's okay. Like I said, I don't expect it to really change anything. It's just a matter of documenting what's happening.
So if you're not trying to change anything, and I get this question all the time, then why? Then why do you write at all if you're not trying to change anything? And, you know, I'm coming from a teaching perspective, and I spent the better part of a quarter of a century actually trying to change things at the personal and societal level. And I gave up on that as well. And I'd like to hear why you ended up in the spot you're in.
Well, I've just recognized that this isn't going to really change, right, until it collapses. Like, people just aren't going to give this up, and corporate power is not going to just all of a sudden hand over, you know, shift their power structures over to the people. None of this is going to happen. So it's, for me, it's just about truth and knowledge, and those two things, you know, to me, outweigh any kind of notoriety or any kind of, you know, being, you know, some sort of eco celeb in the liberal world or anything like that. I mean, I could write things, you know, like Bill McKibben and everybody else that make people feel great and people would share them like crazy and love it, but I'm just not interested. You know, I'm interested in the truth because really that's all we have left.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that. And you mentioned Bill McKibben, and you've written extensively about him and his organization, 350.org. So why don't you give us the Reader's Digest condensed version, the in a nutshell take on 350.org and its figurehead, Bill McGibbon.
Well, I just, the reason I focus on a lot on 350.org and then lately in the past 2 or 3 years on Avaaz is because those are the two NGOs that have really come at this moment in time to have like a lot of appeal with the American public, with the privileged populace. And so I saw right away, like even if you go back to 2007 and McKibben had started a group Step Up, and then you see that sort of morph into an incubator project of the Rockefeller Foundation, One Sky. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's sort of like, okay, which one's going to take off here? Is it going to be One Sky or is it going to be 350.org, which morphed out of Step It Up, and it ended up 350.org was more appealing to the people. And so then you saw back in 2011 a merger of One Sky with 350.org. And so basically this is the NGO that more than the other ones, you know, really appeal to the public, which is a fact not lost in any way on, you know, the elites and the empire. And so Greenpeace, 350.org, Avaaz, they're the three key groups right now at this moment in time that have the power to really implement behavioral change, the type of changes that the empire wants to see, the movements they want to see, the shifts they want to see. And we're made to believe by these, you know, quote-unquote movements, NGOs, you know, chosen leaders, we're made to feel like these are our choices, like we're molding the future, you know, that we want, when really it's all been decided and being decided without us. And so that's the role of these groups, and it's really, really important. And even though people don't want to acknowledge that and don't want to believe that, it is what it is. You know, and then Avaaz goes one step further, and the founders of Avaaz, which include ex-Congressman Tom Perriello, I'm not even sure if I pronounced his name right, I'm not American, but, you know, an ex-Democrat who's tight with Obama and very, very, very much pro-war. And Avaaz was very instrumental in building, you know, sentiment to go in and invade Libya, you know, a sovereign country at that time on, like, a lot of, I mean, Avaaz is up to their neck in blood, you know, and then now the same co-founders have created an PR firm called Purpose in New York City. And right now, this year, they've been really, really gearing up, trying to build acquiescence for the another, you know, basically invasion of Syria, which the U.S. has been, you know, lusting after for years. And so these are, I think, Arun Gupta, in his article, referred to Avaaz as clickbait? Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, but it's not really. It's more bait and switch, and it's very, very dangerous, Avaaz, because they reel people in, you know, with really beautiful images, butterflies, elephants, you know, dolphins, whales, and the next thing you know, within a few years, they're signing on to actually bomb other countries, you know, under the guise of humanitarian intervention. And they're very, very tight and connected. You know, the World Bank, one of the Avaaz co-founders right now, has opened up a PR firm, marketing firm in Burma. His wife, another co-founder of Avaaz, works for the World Bank. These people are all, you know, Harvard graduates. They're part of the establishment. You know, but people want to believe that they speak for us. Well, they don't speak for us. I mean, you know, Rick and Vitel makes almost $200,000 a year, not even including consulting fees. These are part of the establishment, you know, and they work closely with the Gates Foundation. You know, all the creme de la creme of the elites. And this whole climate march was organized you know, by these groups, and people continue to call it a people's march, people's mobilization. They keep referring to this as a people's movement. Well, it was never a people's movement. From the beginning, it was organized by Avaaz, the UN, 350.org, and big money, you know, Wall Street. And the purpose of the march is to create, and in my last article, I have a clip, actually, Forrest Palmer, who you just featured on your show, really brilliant man. He helped me. He did the video, and he cuts out sections of what I found. Jeremy Hyman's, one of the Avaaz co-founders, also co-founder of Purpose, speaking on how we're going to, basically, the green economy is in a slump. It's not going the way they want it. We're going to we're going to ditch the term green, right? Green's no longer a friend. We're not going to call it that anymore. So we're going to build the green economy without saying it's the green economy. And we're going to shift all that market share over to the green economy. And next thing you know, we're going to have it without saying what we were doing.
Right. And they refer to it as the new economy instead of the green economy, because people are starting greenwashing associated with the term green. Claiming you're green doesn't mean you're green. And finally, 10 years into the project of your greenwashing, even the American people are starting to see through it.
Right. Yeah, and you can see that. Like, if you follow the language, I mean, language is so important. And right now, like, even on, you can see this new, right? The new green, the new economy. You just will start to see that word conveyed in papers, conferences, lectures. Right? Green has been ditched.
Right, and it seems to me that the new economy is completely consistent with the 350.org message, that the new economy means austerity for the masses. As McKibben and others fly around the world and drive around the world, what they're trying to tell people is to stop flying around the world and driving around the world. And so they're asking the masses to impose austerity on themselves in the name of, quote, saving the planet.
Well, that and also, like, the illusion of this planet run on windmills and solar, that costs nothing. You know, the resources come from, a fairy tale. Everything's run on, you know, butterfly kisses and love and nothing. You know, there's no fossil fuels. I mean, the whole thing's completely delusional. You know, there's no such thing.
Let me get this straight. You're against butterfly kisses? Is that what I'm hearing?
I'm for butterfly kisses, but I don't think they're going to run. I don't think they're going to power global capitalism. I don't think that's going to happen.
Oh, the tragedy.
Ooh.
Okay, as you probably noticed, I have a live studio audience with me tonight, comprised of my host Peter Melton and friend James Wolfe. So what was your personal path to radicalism? How did you get to this point? You know, you are far more radical than virtually any other writer and speaker and activist out there. And you're not exactly old. So how did you get to this radical point at a relatively young age?
Well, it's sort of funny because I can hear from being surrounded by liberals. I mean, I started out, you know, surrounded by basically mainstream groups, and, you know, Greenpeace and Canada, Council Canadians, what else? You know, Sierra Club people, like all these people, and I started to really question why, you know, their messaging was not anything close to science, you know, to what nature demanded. And I found out pretty quickly, when you put straight questions to people, there's a common theme, and it's silence. There's no answer. And so before, I used to do a lot of activism and community work on the ground, and it just felt like banging my head against the wall. And so basically I took a step back from that. And then from there I started really, really researching, thinking, writing, right? And, I mean, why are we marching and going places and that if we don't even know what we're talking about? If we don't even know who our enemy is, what we're up against, it's pointless. And so I guess by removing myself from that, and that gave me the opportunity to really think and clear my thoughts, and writing gave me the opportunity to, you know, just really figure things out that way.
Right. Once you give up on the notion of influencing outcome, once you give up an attachment to the outcome, it seems to me you can write from a much more honest perspective.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, we're going to have time to take a few calls tonight, if you don't mind, Corey.
Oh, I don't care.
There is 888-874-4888. If you're listening online, you can see the number right up there in the upper right-hand side. Toll-free number, feel free to call in with your questions for Corey, Morningstar, and me. Corey, your writing goes to the root of any number of issues, which makes me think you must have some sort of formula or general approach to your writing, because you repeatedly go deep on a topic and get to places that nobody else seems to get to. So do you have a general approach? Do you have a strategy, a formula that you can share with us?
Not really. I guess I just think outside of myself. I tend to think, how does this affect other people? Like, how does this affect, you know, non-life forms? I don't know. It's not really a secret formula. I don't know. I just believe in fairness, you know, and this whole system's, like, grotesque and the furthest thing from fair.
I think what you're describing might be called empathy. And it's no wonder I don't find the kind of writing that you put out coming from very many other people, because I think we have a culture filled with people who are not very sympathetic, much less empathetic about fellow human beings.
Well, I would agree with that. And as an example, because I really like to look at what's happening today and then go back and look at, you know, when we had real movements. And, you know, even today, like in Canada, Mohawk Warriors, like we still have real radical groups of people. But I was looking at the signs from the parade, the climate parade, and they say 100% renewables for 100% of us. I think something like that, or big orange signs. When in fact, I mean, right now we have 1% of the globe creating 50% of all the emissions. Right? So we have a tiny, basically anyone that can afford to get on a plane is creating half the global emissions. So that sign, what it should say, is 1-3% renewables for us at the expense of 97% of the population, because that's what it is. I mean, even with all these fossil fuels, so many people don't have even, you know, any power at all. I just think we live, you know, like really sheltered, ignorant lives, not understanding the damage that we do to other people, you know, in non-life forms.
I certainly couldn't agree more with that. The ignorance is profound, and in many cases, it's willful. People prefer to remain ignorant. In most cases, I suspect, it's just because of this culture, because of the system generally. So we have created this system that does not reward people who seek meaningful answers to important questions, but instead rewards people with beer and television for focusing on the superficial and pursuing the superficial. We have an audience question right here from Mr. Peter Melton. Go ahead, Peter.
Hello, Corey. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, Peter.
Hey. I've been with Guy for a week now, and we do these talks, and then people talk about the death of these other species. And all the other stuff we're doing, the damage we're causing beyond the human damage, if you will. And I'd love for you to speak to that. I think that's what you were hinting at, is this this place where we have to realize we're more than just humans playing civilization.
You want me to speak to that more?
Yes, please.
Well, one thing, I mean, what was it, Sunday? We had this huge climate parade, 400,000 people. Nothing about war. What is it now? Seven, eight countries now? The U.S. is, you know, openly at war, you know, attacking all these different places. Where is that in the climate march? You know, it's sad to me. It sickens me that that wasn't a huge part. I mean, we all know about climate change. That's not anything new, you know, but another war. Obama had just announced a new war, you know, basically to get in and seize Syria, which they've been trying to take for years. And so, you know, to me, I think how, first of all, I can't explain that really more than, like, I know it's a class issue, but that's also a racist issue. Like, how come we could not give a fuck about other people getting bombed by our governments, you know, and my government included as well, obviously. But, you know, where was that on Sunday? Where, you know, even the fact industrial livestock is a massive, massive contribution to climate change. Where is that? Well, it's nowhere, because who gives a shit about animals, right? They're not people. I mean, everything happening is so human-centric. I mean, everything we look at, if we stopped, you know, I've read things that people write when they say, well, I only care about this because it affects humans. Well, if we cared about everything else, then ultimately we would protect ourselves. If we cared about everything else more than us, at the end of the day, that would protect us. You know, but we don't. I mean, people don't even, I question if people even care about their kids at this point. They care more about their having their stuff and their, you know, their iPods and all their trinkets and shit and SUVs and all their crap, then they even care about their own kids' futures. I mean, that's what it all comes down to. Actions speak louder than words. Those are our actions. I mean, not that we're not all trapped in the system, because most of us are, but that doesn't mean you have to go along with it. You can still try to, you know, you can still try to starve it. You can still try to work outside of it the best you can. But most people are very, very happy, you know, to make that system just chum along. And, you know, it's just really, really sad how people don't care about, you know, non-Anglo people. People don't care. You know, everybody else gets bombed in the world. It's just normal. But if, you know, if that was to happen, you know, wherever, on U.S. soil to white people, it would be like a massive, massive injustice. I mean, we've got just, you know, ample amounts. It's just over the top. We've got racism that runs under this entire system, you know, and everyone just pretends it's not there, it doesn't exist, and we are just, you know, we don't care about other life, you know, sometimes.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. A few thoughts come to mind.
Sorry, I'll just like get on a tangent and go.
Derek Jensen points out that the living planet is primary. Without a living planet, there is no planet that will support us. So even if we are anthropocentric, we should care enough to take care of the species that are taking care of us. Otherwise, we're just eating the seed corn, and the seed corn in this case extends to the entire living planet. Secondly, there was an article in Reuters yesterday morning, supporting exactly what you just said. U.S.-led airstrikes hit grain silos and other targets in Syria and killed civilians and wounded a few militants. And have you heard any outcry about that? Have you heard even any response about that? You're absolutely right. We, in this country, are willing and, in fact, gleeful to kill other people in other countries as long as it doesn't inconvenience us. as long as there's no inconvenience to us, we don't really care what happens.
Well,
so that's horrible.
I can tell you that Purpose, the PR firm I'm talking about, by Avaaz founders, I mean, this speaks volumes. They created a video to, like I said before, to get people to sort of acquiesce to, you know, we have to go and, you know, quote-unquote save Syria, right, with our Obama administration, even though he's the biggest war criminal on the whole planet, right? He's the, there could not be a bigger terrorist than him. Anyway, this video, because Purpose and Avaaz, these advertising, you know, geniuses, they're brilliant at what they do, they recognize that Americans don't really give a shit about, you know, brown, black children on anywhere else. And so they, in their video, use an American white child. And this white child is sad. And as the video goes, the white child's thinking about Syria in her mind and these scary things. And the child becomes scared and sad. So, you know, even that, you know, the advertising firms understand and recognize that, you know, your American people of privilege don't care. They're not going to be moved by a video of a Syrian child. They don't care. They don't care what happened to Libya. They don't care about Iraq. They don't care about Afghanistan. They don't care about the Congo, right? But maybe they'll care enough about that white child in the video, you know, to sign a petition urging Obama, war criminal, to go bomb another country. I mean, it's just crazy, right? It's just mad. You know.
And how do you suppose did we get here? How did we manage to develop an entire culture of people that are incapable of expressing empathy, not only for other human beings, but for the vast majority of non-human species as well? How did that manage to pan out?
Money.
Oh, it's almost as if money talks.
I mean, look, if you go back tonight, I was looking at posters from a group back in 1968 called Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker. That was the name of the group, right? And that was at the time, the Black Panthers, Weather Underground. You had radical groups, and the state was, you know, terrified of these groups, right? Like, they meant business, and they didn't mess around. And now you've got people dancing in the streets with the World Bank and the president of Unilever. I mean, talk about messed up. So, yeah, how did we get here? And, you know, back then when they had those real movements, that's when the money began to pour into the movements. And it's incredible how so many people can be bought off.
I've said this a few dozen times, including a couple of times on this radio show. When greed is your only god, sociopaths assume control. And it appears that's exactly where we are. We are led by people who have no empathy because we don't have any empathy. And so we don't hold anybody to any significant standard with respect to behavior. So the question then arises, where do we go from here? Are we just going to go pedal to the metal, straight to the abyss? Is there, can you talk about things like hope, that four-letter word?
Like hope?
Yeah.
I was reading something about hope today and how, what a dangerous thing that is and what an ineffective thing that is. I don't know. I mean, I think we are going to keep going, and I think it's going to be an ugly ride and an ugly landing. You know, there's what we were talking about before, non-human life. They're making bees now, little robot bees. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen that, but why am I not surprised?
Yeah, I mean, who cares about bees, right? We'll just make robot bees. You know, and those two will be run on, you know, like, you know, maybe they'll be part of the green economy. I don't know why people are so happy to buy into this. And this week I've been wondering, you know, I wonder what Avaz and Purpose take from this. Like, what did they see from what just happened? I mean, Guy, what kind of movement is that? People keep referring to it. Oh, well, this is the start of a movement. Well, movement for what? I mean, what kind of a movement is this? You know, that no one asks, what's this going to change? I mean, all this is for is to bolster green economy, you know, which will just make things worse than they already are. We already know the more green energy we create, the more energy we use. There's nothing about consumption. There's nothing about anything else. It's just burn, 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 use, grow, grow, grow. You know, even the divestment thing is just, you know, complete diversion. Won't change anything. It's not going to stop anything. No one's talking about science, you know, nature, where we are. Like you said already, the species is going extinct. The methane, how's the methane going to stop coming out? If you divest from Exxon and put your money into Lockheed Martin.
Right, right. This is related. It might not sound like it's related in the beginning, but give me a minute here. A woman who hosted a presentation yesterday in Hayward, California. I'm on the California-Oregon circuit right now. She just posted this 4 hours ago in a Facebook group. She says, "Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, I just got a butt-whipping from the head of the IPCC. That's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I fired back asking him to enlighten us on what they plan to do about the methane. And please provide some science that disproves what is happening. He is angry and, quote, disappointed that I'm writing about this because he supported the Art of Climate Change, which was an exhibit she put together. And I'm now disclosing methane news in Guy's presentation. My stance now, you have to prove what's happening, the evidence of things being done to prevent massive releases of methane. There are more than just a few of us that have connected the dots." So, can you comment on that? I mean, here we have the head of the IPCC telling her that she shouldn't be supporting me and my work because it's talking about methane.
Yeah, and they paid her, right? They gave her some funding, is that it?
Well, I don't know.
Does that mean then, or they supported her work, so therefore she should be bowing down on her knees? You know, it's the elites and the liberal classes. So why doesn't she shut up and fall in line?
Yeah, that's the impression I get.
I don't know. It's just crazy. I mean, we're not talking about stopping any of this. We're only, you know, all we're talking about is keep everything growing. Keep growing. You know, keep, I mean, it's just crazy. And there's no stopping it. And when you explain, you know, step by step in detail what is happening, you know, with the articles that came out sort of disclosing what was going on with the climate march, people are so mad, you know, especially what I wrote. And no one says ever, you know, that's not true. You know, you've got that fact is not, that's not a fact. That's not true. They just dismiss it all. They don't want to know. They prefer to be aligned with the people that are oppressing them. So what is that? I mean, Stockholm Syndrome? I don't know. Do we hate ourselves? You know, I mean, we seem like such a bunch of selfish, you know, such a selfish society, and we are, but at the same time, does that mean we hate ourselves? The fact that we're willing to be led to slaughter.
Right, and I think that's a critical point. We are being led to slaughter. You know, in the Warsaw Ghetto, those who resisted had a really, really, really low chance of surviving their time in the Warsaw Ghetto. It was really, really low. But those who did not resist had a 0% chance of surviving. So if you're being led to slaughter, then maybe you should think about resisting.
Yeah, well, I don't see that happening. And if anything, I mean, this climate march is something new. I mean, we haven't really seen people knowingly join hands with their oppressor and defend it like this.
Right. And you know the line from Malcolm X.
Do not march with your oppressor.
Right. You do not march with your oppressor. And it looks like we saw some of that last weekend.
Well, and people don't want to know or don't want to acknowledge that back in, 2014, back in 2009, when the state of Bolivia and the G77 put forth radical emission cuts, you know, that we desperately needed. And when they put forth that we must not exceed 1 degree, you know, going back to 2009, we had the big green groups come in under this tick, tick, tick banner, same thing set up by NGOs and the UN, and destroy that. You know, that was made to be invisible. That's what we needed then. The NGOs who claim they speak for civil society, which they don't, they're an extension of the state, they killed that chance that we had back then. I mean, I don't even know at this point in time, even if back then we could have really stopped anything, but maybe there was a chance, you know, slowing things down a bit. But they threw us under the bus. You know, it's as simple as that. And that's what they're paid to do, you know, protect the state, protect the interests of the state, you know, protect the growth economy. And then 2010 came, you had Bolivia host, poorest country in the world, host a climate conference led by indigenous peoples, 35,000 people. You get one of the best declarations, foundations to build a new system out of this conference. You know, just brilliant. A lot of work went into it. And you get everything that all the quote-unquote left have always claimed they wanted. You get it all in this document. And what did they do with it? They toss it in the garbage. They bury it, they make it invisible, and they continue to this day to put out this crazy number, 2 degree, as some sort of safe target. You know, that's insane. So,
well, right. And stunningly, even the leading climate scientists in the world, Michael Mann and James Hansen, were promoting the idea that 2C is the scientific target until very recently, because of email exchanges involving me, based on information I received ultimately from you, they finally concurred that 2 degrees C was the scientific target. And we've effectively passed that. Even Hansen's work shows that complete collapse of industrial civilization warms us to beyond the 2 degrees C mark. And if we don't collapse industrial civilization, we're going to get there in the not-too-distant future as well.
Yeah, I mean, all of this information is out there if people want to know. But unfortunately, you know, for the most part, people don't really want to know.
And right. That gets us to the media. Why do you suppose do the mainstream media fail to cover any significant topic with any sufficient depth?
Maybe because it's owned by six people that control the whole global economy.
I was going to try to get you to answer without saying the word money, and you're doing great so far.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the media is a joke, right? Knowledge, especially in this society, requires work, right? Everybody here wants everything given to them on a plate. You know, and the NGOs know that too. Like, here's your three sentences. You know, we're going to present to you these three sentences. You know, oh, can you remember this? Tick, tick, tick. You know, I mean, they think the population is stupid. I mean, they have reason to believe that's true. Here's another example of how stupid they think people are. And Sunday, the president, your president, your dictator, whatever, fascist president, whatever you want to call him, war criminal terrorist, whoever handles his Twitter account, he twitters, and this is the day before the U.S. starts bombing Syria, Iraq, He tweets, are you ready to walk the walk? Something like that. It's a three-syllable thing, right? It's a hashtag, walk the walk. It's basically an open source tool for social media, just like, if you remember, Tick, 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 another three-syllable open source tool for social media, both at pivotal moments before COP15 in Copenhagen, and right now, before, during the biggest climate spectacle on the planet. Well, if you go to that account, that's made up by Purpose, which is Avaz, and they have, at that time, 167 followers, which is nothing. So how do you get the president of a country using the social media hashtag you presented unless you're completely embedded in the conversation from the beginning? I mean, they're part of the establishment. They're all working together. I mean, this whole thing is such a charade. You know, and what? So they're going to give us, what, a carbon tax, and then we'll say, oh, look, we won.
Right. And so talk to me about a carbon tax a little bit.
I actually don't really have that much knowledge on the carbon tax. I've been sort of reading about that in the past couple of days, asking people if they're seeing a big push for that after the climate march. I just know basically the carbon tax allows things like biofuel and nuclear just to go, you know, keep growing and be completely protected away from a carbon tax. How about you? Like, do you know a lot about it? Like, I know that's not going to stop anything.
Well, no. I mean, it seems to me that it's more of the same, that it's the civilized approach to dealing with a predicament rooted in civilization.
Yeah.
As Tim Garrett pointed out in a paper written more than 7 years ago, only collapse of civilization prevents runaway climate change. And people tell me I'm misinterpreting that paper. So I wrote to him and asked him what he really meant. Did he really mean complete collapse of civilization is the only hope for preventing runaway climate change? And he responded affirmatively. Yes, that's what he means. And it appears quite clear now that even collapse of industrial civilization leads to runaway climate change because of the sulfates in the atmosphere that are serving as an umbrella cooler at this point.
Exactly. Like, there's really no way out.
Right, right. Okay. We're out of time, Corey.
We are.
Thank you very much for being with us here this evening, and I look forward to our next conversation. Thanks very much, Corey Morningstar.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
Each week, we seek out a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo in their rhetoric or analysis, but also provides insightful and useful information to the issues at hand. Our doomer of this week is Joan Haynes, who recently posted the following on the Facebook page for the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group. I'd rather read doomer material than work, but I'm neglecting my family and business and my exercise. I'm obsessed and can't look away. Most other things seem so trivial, like that 10 extra pounds I want to lose. Eating more donuts lately, so yummy. I'm going out with a muffin top. There's nothing like near-term human extinction to remind us what's important in life. I'll end tonight's show with a very brief climate change update that can also be found at NatureBatchLast, GuyMcPherson.com. The European Space Agency announced 4 days ago on their website that Antarctic ice melt is causing a change in the phenomenon we tend to think of as extremely stable, gravity. Right. The Antarctic ice melt is a result of climate change. It's causing a change in the gravitational force of this planet. That about wraps it up this week. Tune in next week as I have an informal conversation with my host, Peter Melton, and also with Rhys Jones. Ms. Jones has interviewed me several times, and I intend to turn the tables with the ever-companionable Mr. Melton by my side. Be sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. Please continue to follow my blog, Nature Bats Last, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. On the latter topic, I'm hosted by Peter Melton in Chico, California, and Ashland, Oregon, for the next few days. I'll be hosted by Kevin Hester in New Zealand in a month. You can also keep abreast of both speaking tours on my blog and on Facebook. Finally, if you're finding yourself in need of support in dealing with these heavy issues, please find the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group page on Facebook and join the conversation. There are plenty of people going through a similar emotional roller coaster who help provide some personal insight into these most monumental of issues. A few days ago in that group, Alexis Pinkerton wrote, quote, when you first learn about NTHE, that's Near-Term Human Extinction, it can be overwhelming. It can be paralyzing. It can consume your thoughts. People around you might not want to hear about it, even when it's all you want to talk about. People who have long since accepted it might tell you to chill out and not worry about things beyond your control. And all of it can be frustrating. How are you feeling and dealing today? End quote. This is a compassionate question, and I can assure you it's posted with genuine care and respect. Consistent with the idea of joining others along this path, David Petratus is organizing a support group in Manhattan. Please contact him via email at nyc@extinction.support. His website is www.extinction.support. I'll see you on the radio next Tuesday evening. It'll be an informal, wide-ranging conversation. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last. Thanks again to the excellent contributions this week and to AfroZen for the theme song, starting now.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer species on the planet than the year before that. We're driving 200 species a day to extinction. We're about to see that turn around. The loving planet is about to make a comeback. And that's really, really good news.
She bats last and she's coming out swinging.